I'll call to order the meeting of the State Government Budget Division for Tuesday, April 21st, 2009. We still do not have a quorum present, but I want to get started to get these bills moving. Today, we've got a number of bills that have some fiscal notes on them, and we wanted to process those so that we can get those moving through the Finance Committee. Sartorius Ray, we'll start with your bill, Senate File 185. That's the Legislative Coordinating Commission Ethnic Heritage and Cultural Diversity Authority Expiration Expansion. Welcome to the Budget Division. It looks like you've got a fairly straightforward bill, Sartorius Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Rest. Yes, this bill.
I'm not chair. I'm the chair.
No, I said Chair and
okay.
Senator Rest.
She was just greeting the two
I
of
see.
Just the two,
okay.
Since
okay.
There are the two
I
of
see.
You.
Okay, I'm with you. Okay, thank you. Okay.
I already went through Senator Rest's committee,
okay.
Mr. Chairman. And you're
okay,
correct.
Okay, let the record reflect we've got a quorum, finally. Okay, thank you. Okay.
I got a call because I apologize.
Okay.
I forgot.
Go ahead, Senator Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill is just to request an extension of the Ethnic Heritage and New Americans Working Group beyond the June 30th, 2009 expiration date to 2011. And, Mr. Chairman and members, the reason I am asking for this extension is that we had somewhat of a difficult time kind of coming together at the beginning for the group. And particularly, it was challenging for us to come to an agreement as to what is the actual mandate, what was the intent behind this legislation, and how we can put some ideas together to comply with this legislation. And as you can see in the bill, it says that the activities determined by this group are supposed to assist state government to foster an understanding and appreciation of ethnic and cultural diversity in the state of Minnesota, and et cetera. So we were trying to determine kind of the scope of the work of this group, and we are finally getting there. We have an outstanding group of people that have come to help us, but we have run out of time. And now that we are ready to start completing the work, and there was also a suggestion that we need to include some voices from rural Minnesota and perhaps visit a couple of regions to hear from some immigrant communities that are outside of the metro area. But we didn't have the time to do so, Mr. Chairman, and that is the reason we're coming before you to see if we can get an extension to continue to do our work.
Of course, as a budget division, our main concern is going to be the cost, which looks like about a $17,000 cost in the 2010 fiscal year. Mr. Hubinger, I saw you here.
Yes.
Mr. Hubinger, you know, you've been tracking the budget issues. You know, in our budget division, of course, we had a 5% cut within the LCC. Do you know how this is going to be playing out within the LCC, or do you have you had any hint in where this might wind up with the LCC?
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Greg Hubinger with the LCC. Mr. Chair, we show that cost is being absorbed. The vast bulk of that is for our fiscal staff for processing per diems and expense payments for members. The out-of-pocket costs run about $2,500 for the per diems and expense reimbursements for the public members. So the out-of-pocket cost for us is actually quite small, and we've budgeted for this coming out of our contingency account.
Okay, thank you. Any questions of either Sartorius Ray or Mr. Hubinger?
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the bill.
Senator Rest moves that Senate File 185 be reckoned to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Senator Marty just stepped out, so Senator Rest, I think you're the only other author in the moment.
Okay.
At the moment, why don't we get to your two bills?
Senator Marty.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Marty's here. Okay, we'll do your bill, since you're not a member of the Budget Division. This is Senate File 660, Automatic Voter Registration for Driver's License Applicants. Senator Marty, welcome to the Budget Division, and just tell us a little bit about what the bill does. And
sure.
We'll be looking mainly at the fiscal note, since this is the Budget Division.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members, this is a bill that would make it when you register, you get a new driver's license or voter or identification card, state identification card, the data from that would be used in a variety of ways. First of all, you would be automatically, unless you chose not to, you'd be automatically registered to vote. And then at the same time, what we are doing is providing that data would be available to the Secretary of State's office. And if you look through the bill, there are a number of other provisions where other agencies would be providing them information. Secretary of State would run this information into their database to check to make sure Social Security lists, make sure people are not deceased. They'd be checking it with the court administrator to find out if people had lost their license because of guardianship or whatever, that they lost their right to vote, or if they were restored, their competency was declared okay, so they were removed from the guardianship, that they have the right to vote again. Felony convictions from the courts would be provided so they know when a person is not eligible to vote, when they're restored to have their voting rights. So bottom line, what this does is it takes its automatic voter registration at the time you register, and the biggest advantage of it is that because the data is entered automatically, it will save a lot of money for counties and local election officials because they don't have to hand enter the data from the voter registration cards. There'll be a lot fewer people registering to vote by paper things, because when you change your address, when you move and you get a new driver's license, then it automatically would be updated. And the estimates are that it will save a lot of money from the counties and local election officials. The other thing it does is it makes the voter registration list much more accurate, because the Secretary of State's office has it all available to double-check these lists. I didn't look at the fiscal note. Ms. Fraser from the Secretary of State's office is here and can answer questions.
It appears that it can be paid for by the federal Help America Voter Act account money, which, of course, is why it wasn't looked at as part of our budget division. Ms. Fraser, is this how it would be paid for?
Mr. Chair and members, Beth Fraser with the Office of the Secretary of State. Yes, it can be covered by the Help America Vote Act funds.
So then there'd be no impact on the general fund as far as this.
That's right.
Okay. Got it. That would be obviously our main concern. Is there anybody else who's here who wants to be heard on this bill, Senate File 660? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the
Sarah Rest moves that Senate File 660 be recommended as it came to us amended. Be recommended passed be referred to the Committee on Finance. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails.
No.
I'm sorry. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Romney.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the
committee. Okay. And I don't see Senator Seba nor Senator Tomasoni. Senator Seba's here. I'm sorry. You're way back there hiding. Thank you, Senator Seba. Okay. We've got three bills. Did you have a preference as to which one we take up first, Senator Seban?
No, Mr. Chair.
Senate File 768 is election ballot validity and automatic vote recount provision. Senator Seban, welcome to the Budget Division. It looks like 768 does not really have a fiscal impact. Maybe you could just very briefly describe what it is. Since it doesn't have a fiscal impact, we probably don't need to spend a lot of time in here. We have the bills come here so we know whether or not they do have a fiscal impact. So, Senator Seba?
Right. Mr. Chair, if anything, I think that this bill in the end will end up saving money to local units of government and perhaps to the state, because it will very likely reduce the number of recounts that need to happen as a result of close elections. So, just to run through the sections of the bill real briefly, if you'd like me to. The first section is in response to the Supreme Court ruling, which would simply say that candidates cannot determine whose ballot is rejected. In Section 2, it makes clarifying language to identify, to say that stray marks on a ballot would not invalidate it. Section 3 is a main part of the bill. It would lower the threshold for when a recount would occur from 0.5%, which is current law, down to 0.25%. And the Secretary of State's office told me that in 2008, that would have reduced the number of recounts that occurred in the state from 8 to 2. Obviously not the U.S. Senate race, which is all on our minds. The last part of Section 3 says that a candidate must request the recount. In some cases, we heard testimony where where recounts were automatically triggered even though candidates did not necessarily even want them to happen. And then moving on to on page 3, it's sort of just conforming language to what I just described. On page 4, under section 5, this is clarifying language that passed last year that lets legislative candidates file either at their county or with the Secretary of State. And in section 6, this would change the percentage for when a recount is triggered for county, city, or school district elections. Again, or from one-half to one-quarter of a percent when the total number of votes cast is more than 25,000. And then in section 7, it deals with challengers who are in challengers when there is a recount. It would make changes that say that a candidate's representative needs to be a resident of Minnesota, provide written authorization from their candidate that they're supposed to be there, has completed training with the Secretary of State's office, and there can only be one representative per candidate per precinct in the recount area. So that's an overall summary of the bill.
Okay, and although the fiscal note doesn't book any numbers, it does indicate, you know, as you stated, that it does indicate that there's probably going to be some savings to local governments because by this bill it would be probably fewer recounts locally, but they don't assign a number on it. But is there any questions of the author? Is there anybody who's here who wants to be heard on SFL 768? Senator Russ moves that Senate File 768, as it was amended, it came to us, be recommended pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed. The motion prevails. Okay, Senator Sieben, then Senate File 970, Early Voting Authorization. And this does have a fiscal note with some numbers on it. Senator Sieben?
Mr. Chair, Senate File 970 would allow for an early voting system in Minnesota. Right now, I'm sure the committee members know that we have an absentee voting system here in the state, but and there obviously have been some concerns with the absentee voting system, the way that that were highlighted in the most previous U.S. Senate race. So the idea for why it would be a good idea to institute early voting in Minnesota is largely that it would be a convenience process for Minnesota voters. It would allow Minnesotans to vote at designated locations in cities and counties before an election up till the fourth day before the election. And I'm happy to go through the bill specifically, but just to touch briefly on the fiscal note, and Ms. Fraser from the Secretary of State's office could certainly speak to this more, but there would be some state expenditures for updating the statewide voter registration system, but the Secretary of State's office can use funds from the Help America Vote account to fund this cost. And again, I think in subsequent years, if local governments are able to utilize early voting, it has a very likely potential of reducing costs to those local units of government because they won't need to send out as many absentee ballots, and that will therefore see a reduction in staff time and envelope and postage savings.
Well, and Senator Sieben, as you may note, if you look around, everybody here except for Senator Kubley is on the policy committee, so who's here right now? So I think most of the members are familiar with the provisions of the bill. And then, Ms. Fraser, if you could let us, it does appear that the cost of this bill would be covered then by the Help America Vote account. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr.
Okay,
Chair.
So there would not be any cost to the state then?
That's
okay.
Correct.
Is there anybody else who's here who wants to be heard on Senate File 970? Senator Robling.
I just wanted to find out, you said that there wouldn't be any
major cost to the state, but I'm just wondering about the local units of government as they are required to have. I see it looks like most of it's during normal business hours, but there is some requirement that they be open for voting in March for the townships, but I guess that's current law. I'm just wondering about the local units of government and how they're to receive these early voters, if they each have to have a place open or if they can go to the courthouse. I'm trying to remember the discussion in committee. For example, if a school board has an off-year election, where do those people go for early voting?
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, I may need Ms. Frazier's help with this, but first, I think it's important just to remind you, in the bill, there's language that says that at least one night during early voting, a location needs to be open until 8 p.m., but that is already what is required under the absentee, under administering absentee balloting, so that would not be an additional burden for local units of government.
Would the HAVA funds cover the local government costs, or those are only for the state? Ms. Frazier, how do HAVA funds cover any local costs here?
Mr. Chair and members, HAVA funds can cover some election costs in the administration of federal elections, but not of exclusively local elections. But to answer Senator Roebling's question, in part, the use of early voting for school districts and townships in their standalone elections was delayed for several years. So that's not really an issue for those jurisdictions in the immediate future, because there were concerns about how it would work and how the smaller governments would handle it. So this would be put in place sooner for state elections and county and city elections, but not for school boards and townships.
Senator Rust.
Well, I would also, Senator Roebling, may want to look at the fiscal note in the local government costs. I haven't decided whether I support early voting yet or not. I mean, I'm not going to hold up the bill, but I have some philosophical objections to people not all voting with the same knowledge at the same point in an election. So I have get a little bit uncomfortable with that, but I appreciate the fact that the bill took it down to 15 days rather than the original 30. In some places, I think some states they even have longer than that. Didn't you do that?
Madam Chair, Chair and Senator Rest, the bill,
30?
It's still 30 days. The House version of the bill is now 15 days.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I
would be more supportive of that than the 30, but anyway. I was looking at the bill description says that it was,
put some lipstick on.
I thought it says 15 days there. So that's wrong. Is that right? Are you looking at the fiscal note, the top page 2?
Yes, I see where it says 15 days.
It should have been 13 days, 30 days?
30 days.
For this bill, it's 30 days. It's the House bill that is 15 days, which I like better. Anyway, going to the local government costs, I think it's interesting that the initial of doing both, Senator Roebling, where they estimate $400,000 would be the statewide cost for local governments. They say once that is established that there'd be significant savings to local governments in election judges, because they assume that people would take advantage of the early voting, and they would have to have fewer election judges. And they estimate that the savings would be $840,000. And so there's a net savings of almost $450,000 once the program would get, fully engaged. And I think that's where we're looking for cost savings without any loss of the effectiveness of the policy that That's something that speaks in its favor, although I remain uncomfortable about a 30-day early voting time myself, personally. So I accept that there would be savings in doing this.
Okay, Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And there probably would be savings for some of the bigger precincts, but some of the smaller ones have to have X number of election judges no matter what, whether they have...
So it's a statewide savings, right. not yeah. Individual.
15 people show up or not. But on that point of how far ahead you can vote early, I am interested in reducing that 30-day also. A lot can happen in 30 days, and it seems like that's really pushing voters pretty far out from when the general election is. And the other thing I'm curious about, and this is on 5.13, why would it only go through the fourth day before the election and not include the day before the election? Because I think that's when a lot of people often come and vote yet. And I think other states, I'm thinking of South Dakota, they have 2 weeks before the election they can do early voting. And I believe it includes the day before the election.
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, to answer your second question or your second point first, the reason we put that early voting would be available through the Friday before the election is so that election officials would have time to prepare their voting rolls for the general election, because early voting is unlike absentee voting, where if you cast an absentee ballot, you could still show up in the polling place on election day and cast a regular ballot. But early voting, you will not be able to do that. So election officials wanted time to be able to mark their roster to ensure that that people could not vote early and then show up on election day and try to vote again. And regarding the Monday before, people still could vote absentee the Monday before the election if they so chose. And so to go to your second point about the 30-day time period, I quite honestly too would have preferred a shorter period to begin with, but I was persuaded by the Secretary of State's office that it would be easier to administer an early voting period if it was consistent with the absentee voting period. Mm-hmm. Because right now people can vote absentee 30 days before, and one of the main drivers, I think, of having an early voting system is to get people away from voting absentee so that they're actually casting a regular ballot. And so that's why I decided to go with the 30-day period. But I think that the House feels, from what I heard from the debate in the House, that they, like I said, they did prefer a shorter period, at least to begin with. And I've also heard that the governor's office perhaps would support a shorter period as well. So,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
On page 5, line 12, I would move to strike the 30 and put in 15. So what does that give us? Does that work out so it's like two-week period
less
before the election? Would that be the right
be
number?
Less, because fourth day they have to stop.
Okay. But would it be the full 2 weeks before the election if we said 15 days? Or what would we need to do?
Be the Monday.
You'd have to do it from
be the Monday.
It'd be 11 days.
You'd have to strike through
and four
through the fourth day.
You'd have to do 19.
Mr. Chair, I think if you changed it to 15 days, it would be the Monday 2 weeks before the election plus one day. So the Monday 2 weeks before the election, it would start.
But it would end, Madam Chair, Mr. Chairman. But if you end it the fourth day before the election, then you have really less than 15 days to vote.
Right. You'd have two.
So if you wanted two full weeks, you'd have to have.
You'd have to 19 days.
Well, yeah. Presumably, 15 days would be the Monday 2 weeks prior to the election, and then go through that week plus the weekend, plus the following Monday through Friday, and then stop the Friday before the election. Mm-hmm. And then it would, you cannot do the early voting that weekend or the day before the election. So
18
that would, if you backed it up, it would, if you backed it up, it would include the prior weekend. But 15 days would start the Monday 2 weeks prior to the election.
Okay, just strike. And 5:15.
Mr. Chair, I'm thinking, and I'd ask Secretary of State's office, they didn't want to do the Saturday, because if they're going through Friday anyway, and a lot of those polling places are open the Saturday before election. In fact, that's when a lot of people have gone in and voted absentee in person. Mm-hmm. I would think that would be really helpful if we could include that Saturday before the election. But then it would be only that it would end 3 days before the election. And include however many days we need to back up for those full 2 weeks. So, what did you have?
It does strike me, I think that there is some merit to be saying that these local judges do need a little bit of time to sort out the, you know, the who voted early and then reconcile those with the voting thing. So I think you need a little bit of a gap. You can't just go right up to election day, I think. But let's hear from the Secretary of State's office.
We have Monday.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so if you give at least Monday, but I think that the reason why they wanted the weekend, too, was for that. But I don't know.
But Mr. Chairman, you could do in-person absentee.
Right. Yeah.
Even on Monday, you can do in-person absentee.
But they
just can't do, they can't do the straightforward early.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, with absentee, they don't open the ballot until election day. I think the work involved with early voting is they actually count the ballot.
No,
and
I understand
they have to
that,
mark
but I'm
the
just
roster
saying that
as that fact they voted.
It's not as if you couldn't vote in person on the Monday before
right.
election. It just has to be an in-person absentee ballot that will not be counted until
right.
Tuesday, and you still would have the privilege of going in and
changing.
Voting regularly in person and having your absentee ballot set aside.
Ms. Fraser, and if there's anybody else here who wants to be heard on this issue, please come forward. Ms. Fraser, what's the position of the Secretary of State on changing the 30 days to 15 or even some other date?
Mr. Chair and members, the part of the reason for urging Senator Sieben to go with 30 days and believing that that's what makes the most sense. We had originally thought a shorter period made sense, and then as we talked to election administrators, what they said is, It's easier for them to say, okay, if somebody comes in person, then it's early voting. If they're voting by mail, then it's absentee. It gets confusing if somebody comes in on the 16th day and you say, okay, let me get out the envelopes, let me get out, you know, you have to fill out this application, you have to do all these extra things to vote, whereas if you come in the next day, you're handed a ballot and you fill it out and put it in the ballot box. That it's just a clearer distinction between the two that is administratively easier. So that was what convinced us, was the local election administrator saying that they thought that distinction made more sense. In terms of the Saturday before the election, not only do the rosters have to be marked, but the election supplies have to be delivered to the precincts. And in the, you know, in different parts of the state, they begin doing that at different periods of time. They often begin Thursday or Friday of the week before, getting those to the head election judges. You know, in some counties, some of the election judges are, you know, 100 miles away from the county. And so it's not just a matter of marking the paper and then the person comes in on Monday and can easily get the supplies to the precinct Tuesday at 6 a.m. So there is, depending on the part of the state, greater or lesser challenges with geography and other factors. So they really do need time to mark the rosters. Most states that have early voting, I believe, do not have early voting the weekend before the election. Some do. Some, like Oklahoma, I believe, do. And then they don't mark the rosters. They just trust that people won't come in and vote again. We didn't think that was the prudent approach, so our proposal has been to stop early voting early so that there is enough time to mark the rosters and ensure that people don't get to cast more than one vote.
as everybody knows, I don't really care what the other body does. However, at this stage of session, it seems to me that if we picked a number that was different from what the other body does, at least there's some negotiation or things you can talk about. If we pick the exact same number, you know, then, you know, we're almost locked into that. So I'm just, you know, just throwing that out there that, and again, is the House at 15 days prior to the election? Is that where they're at? So I'm just, that's some consideration. Senator Roebling has moved 15 days, but if you want to pick a different number, then we've got some leeway to discuss and negotiate a different number. Or if you like 15 days, we can go with that. So. So Senator Roebling's motion, so.
Well, Mr. Chair, maybe I'll withdraw the amendment, but hope that we can continue to work on this as we move forward, because.
But did you want to suggest 19 days or something? Or?
Yeah, maybe. It wouldn't. I would like to get the whole 2 weeks before.
Before the cutoff.
Before the cutoff. And I really would like to get that Saturday in, because that's a heavy voting day, either by absentee. Normally it's a heavy voting day by absentee before people might go out of town for that next week or whatever. But if it can't be done, and I don't want not to have the rosters checked, that does pose a problem. But I think that people who come in early to vote, they still would maybe be better served. If they come in a month before the election and they vote as an early voter and it goes right into the ballot box and there's no retrieving it and no revoting, they may regret it.
Yes, oh yeah.
And at least if it's just 2 weeks before, there will be less regrets, because fewer things may become apparent during the campaign that they would be concerned about. So I guess I don't want to push it out that far. To match the absentee ballot. I don't mind telling people if it's that far out, you need to vote absentee, but then you have an opportunity to come back in and vote a different way yet.
I mean, why don't you pick a different number, like 17 or 19 days, and then the third day before the election.
Okay,
I'll pick that so we can
talk about it.
Pick something.
I'm going to amend my amendment to say it will be 17 days before the election through the third day before the election.
Okay, discussion. Rest.
And with that, because it's the third day before, that would allow the Saturday before to be an early voting day. Is that correct?
I was trying to get at that, Senator Rest.
Okay, and the reason, only reason I'm asking that is that if you look at the hours for early voting, if it stopped the fourth day before, then on your 17 days, there'd only be one Saturday, and so you would want to require that it be open
that Saturday.
Be open on Saturday, period.
But
since you're changing it to third day, then they have the choice of choosing the one Saturday that's in those 2 weeks or the Saturday before the election. So they'd have one Saturday, but they could choose not to do the Saturday before the Tuesday election. Do you see what I mean?
Oh, well, under Senator Roebling's motion right now, you have three possible Saturdays. The very first day would be a Saturday, and then a week later, and then the weekend before the election. If you're going 17 days out prior to the election date, you'd have a possibility of three different Saturdays.
Oh, I only intended two, probably. 16.
Well, no, that's a 15? Sunday.
Sunday?
You have to count Sunday.
Okay.
No, it would only be one.
Okay.
I think. I wrote all a little calendar here. 16. It would start on 17 days would start on a Sunday.
Should we just
18 days would give you a choice.
22.
So, Mr. Chair, so the choice would be that they wouldn't have to be open that Saturday. They have to be open one Saturday during that open during that early voting.
On 5.17, it says at least one Saturday.
So if we did 18, they could do
one of three.
One of three. So they wouldn't have to have it the Saturday before if they are if they are an election site that has a lot of setup to do in further away locations, they wouldn't have to have it the Saturday before right. then. I'm okay with that.
So is your motion 18. On page 5.12, change 30 to 18?
Correct. 18
and on 5.13, change 4th to 3rd?
Correct.
Okay, is there, Ms. Fraser, if anybody else wants to be heard on this issue, Senator Seaman?
Well, Mr. Chair, like I said, you know, I'm not as concerned about the first part of Senator Roebling's amendment to change the mm-hmm. period for early voting. I would prefer to keep it 30 at this point and go and have that discussion in conference. But I really feel I did hear loud and clear from local election administrators about ending early voting on the Friday before. And it's unfortunate that representatives from the League of Cities, for instance, aren't here, but sure. I know they do feel very strongly that they would like to end that the Friday before the election. So I just want to make that very clear that
although under this scenario, even the language that we have right now, they could still do that, because if they only have to do at least one Saturday, if they do it one of the two that are previous, they don't have to do it
Mr. the Saturday Chair. Before. Mr. Chair, I'd also...
I think that's a little ambiguous because okay. it does say it needs to be available the third day before the election.
Oh, I see. Okay, available, I'm sorry, third through the third day. Must be available through the third day before the... Okay, thank you, Mr. Bowder. Yes.
Also, Mr. Chair, to that point, I think it... When you think about voter registration, or I'm sorry, voter get out the vote efforts, right. it's important to have some sort of consistency so that campaigns and candidates can notify voters of when polls will be open. So I just think that if in some locations, if we would have Saturday voting, early voting before the polls open, in some locations not, it does get more dicey, exactly because of Senator Roebling's point that people may want to vote that Saturday before, but at least this way it would be consistent where they, if they did that, they would still have to cast an absentee ballot.
Okay. Senator Roebling?
Well, I'll amend again.
Yeah. Go ahead.
And say that we'll leave it at, we'll just eliminate the change on line 5.13.
Okay.
So it stays the fourth day before okay. the election.
So your motion is to change 5.12 from 30 to 18?
Correct.
Okay. Does anybody else want to be heard on that issue? Is there discussion on that motion? Senator Roebling moves in a page 5, line 12, change 30 to 18. On that motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. And I suspect that, although we didn't get any numbers here for that part of the fiscal note, I suspect that does bring down the cost to the local government, because it was 30 days, and now it's going to be a shorter period of time, I think. So okay. that might help out. Senator Limmer.
Question for Secretary of State. by crunching the time down in some communities, do they own their voting machines or do they rent?
Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I believe they all own the machines.
They all own. Okay. All right.
Okay. Is there any further discussion then on Senate File 970 as amended? Senator Rest moves that Senate File 970 as amended be recommended pass be referred to the Committee on Finance. Discussion on that motion. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, the motion prevails. And Senator Seaban, your third bill is Senate File 1331, Elections, Absentee Ballot, and Secretary of State Requirements. Senator Seaban. And
Mr.
this has
Chair,
a fiscal note as well, too. Go ahead.
Right. And members, I can be as detailed as you'd like me to be, but the Senate File 1331, the main points of what the bill does is it would stop the processing of absentee ballots in the precinct at the precinct level and instead have absentee ballots accepted or rejected at a centrally central location at either the county or city level.
I wonder what the impetus of that was. But anyway. Okay. But and the fiscal note looks like it'd be covered by the Help America Vote Act account. Ms. Fraser, that's correct.
Yes, Mr.
So there would be no cost to the state because of this. Okay. Anybody want to be heard on this issue? Any discussion on it? Senator Rest then moves that Senate File 1331, as it came amended to us, be recommended pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee. On that motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Seaban.
Thank you.
Sir Tomasoni, we have a fiscal note which has almost nothing on it. So, sir, this is the Senate File 702, State Employees Vacation Donation Program Modifications. Sir Tomasoni, welcome to our budget division.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I've been in front of your committee before.
It's a treat. Oh, the first engrossment. There was a first engrossment, so the bill you have, members, set that aside. And I take it that the fiscal note was drawn to the first engrossment?
Yeah.
Okay, so, yes, okay. So, Senator Tomasoni, just, I guess, basically describe what it is, but all the bills in Finance Committee, as you know, have to go somewhere, and since this budget division has the oversight over the Minnesota management and budget issues, that's why it came here. But if it doesn't have much of a fiscal note, you know, we would not be spending a lot of time on it. So go ahead and briefly describe what it does.
And Mr. Chairman, all the bill does is expands the current vacation donation program for state employees by allowing additional vacation hours to be donated to the program. And then the bill also provides donations are retroactive to the point of time where the approved recipient exhausts all form of paid leave. The department's okay with that. That it's one of those kind of things that when the recipient would have exhausted their forms of paid leave, they would then have to apply for the vacation donation program, and oftentimes they would have a gap in when they got benefits. And so this just allows them to go retroactive. And then finally, the bill expands the program to provide for a consultation with the commissioner or the commissioner's designee on behalf of the program applicant who has received an unfavorable determination. So in other words, he was denied vacation donation program benefits, and so we allow them to at least appeal it. And this was worked out with the department, and I think it's non-controversial at this point in time. But Mr. Chairman, I've been asked to put an A6 amendment on.
Oh, how would I? Okay.
Which I don't think is controversial either, but.
Does it have anything to do with hockey?
No, there's no hockey in this amendment.
Okay.
Okay. Well, you have the A6 amendment there. Okay. And what this is about, it's about a vacation leave accrual, counting all your years of service in civil service, federal government, and Minnesota local unit of government, as well as military vacation donation. Probably the best way to do this is to have Mr. Blumhauer explain it, why it's a good idea. The effective date on it makes it prospective, so it doesn't go retroactive, and it would go forward from here. And there might possibly be a fiscal note on it later, but I don't know about that right now. So maybe I'll let Mr. Blumhauer explain this.
Mr. Blumhauer, welcome to the Budget Division. You'll need to identify yourself for the record.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, my name is Dan Boomhauer. I'm Director of Human Resources for the Minnesota Senate. And Senate File 702 expands the use of donated vacation for employees, family, illness, and so forth. And under the current vacation plan in the state, they count prior government and military service that goes back 10 years prior to the appointment in the state service, but they don't count any service that goes back beyond 10 years. And this amendment would simply eliminate that 10-year look-back period and count any service in the military or prior state service, even if it was farther back than 10 years. And the reason that this amendment is suggested is that MSRS, for instance, counts any credible service for pension purposes, and it seems to be a little bit of a disconnect that it's not the same standard for vacation. In addition, the current policy discriminates against Vietnam-era veterans, veterans of the Gulf War, and there's been some other bills that have been encouraging service from veterans and so forth. And then finally, counting service older than 10 years would aid selection efforts. Currently, there's a hiring freeze on in state government, but with the number of retirements and that sort of thing coming up, it would be an aid in selection. I guess in summary, the fact that the service is older than 10 years out shouldn't really diminish service that the servicemen or prior governmental employees have made to the state or local government. And this would be prospective in nature. So from an administration standpoint to the state agencies, there would really be no administrative burden in that regard. The burden would be on the employee to prove that they did, in fact, have that prior service.
It's an interesting idea, and it sounds like it's been one that needs to be done, but I'm just kind of curious when this issue kind of surfaced. I mean, we're kind of late in the session right now. Did this somebody just realize this, you know, a week or so ago and say, oh, my gosh, we got to correct this?
No, actually, it was surfaced last summer, and I think the council's office worked on some language and that sort of thing, and it's just at this point getting into the hopper.
Well, it's an arrest.
Mr. Chairman, what does it do to the fiscal note?
I don't know. Mr. Yocum? Welcome to the Budget Division.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kurt Yocum with Minnesota Management and Budget. Off the top of my head, I can't tell you what it might do to the fiscal note, but when you start dealing with vacation time, that's part of an employee's salary. When they separate from service, that is also paid out. So I'm just assuming that there would be some sort of note on this, but I don't know. I can't tell you what dollar amount that might be.
I understand. Members, we will have at least one more meeting because Senator Gerlach had this one bill that we laid over that he was going to work on. We've got Senator Lurie has his gambling bill. There's a bill or two in the pipeline that we've been trying to find out if it's dead or alive in the House or what the status is. So we've got a few bills that we do need to look at. We could adopt this, and then Senator Thomasoni just laid over it just to see what the fiscal note is, if any, before it goes to the full Finance Committee. So
that works.
Why don't we do that, members? You know, just okay. Senator Rest moves the A6 amendment. Anybody else want to be heard on the A6 amendment?
Senator
Roebling.
I think I have a problem with the A6 amendment.
Okay.
I do think it's going to cost some money. And I mean, if this had not been in current law that we have to look back 10 years, I would say we should never do it in the first place that we're bringing together all of these civil service positions. I mean, why wouldn't we be mainly worried about if you'd worked in the state service? And if you came from another level of government, how come you get to carry that over? I mean, you don't get to do that in the private sector, and I don't know why we should encourage it so much in the public sector that you get to carry over all these benefits. So your accrual of vacation leave. Do we also have a 10-year look back for sick leave? What else do we have going on here? I don't know. It's just something that the private sector has. I mean, you never get this. And so I don't know why we should be doing it in the public sector at the expense of taxpayers.
Again, Senator Thomasoni or Mr. Boomhauer, did you want to respond there?
Mr. Chairman, I'm just guessing that if we move the vacation donation hours up from 12 to 40 and the fiscal note is zero, that this, since it's not effective until July 1st of 2009, is probably going to be a very minimal fiscal note also. The state policy that we have right now for counting the service of people is a policy that we endorse, and whether or not the private sector likes it, I don't know, but people do make choices as to where they work, and I can't comment on Senator Roebling's rationale as to why they don't have it in the private sector, but it is available.
It costs money.
Well, it is available, and it is is part of what employees benefits here in the state. And so I'm just trying to do something that seems to be a logical thing to me.
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, I have 25 years of private sector human resources experience, and my experience in a number of companies is that they do credit prior experience. It's negotiable at the time of hire, and it's quite common for employees to negotiate sick leave, particularly people that have experience and so forth, that's factored in.
Mr. Chair, And I would say that might be true for top executives when they get to negotiate, but the line worker does not get to negotiate that type of a thing.
And he does.
Senator Lumber.
Thank you. Senator Tomasoni, maybe you could explain this again. A state employee appointed to a civil service position shall accrue vacation leave previously held in civil service, federal government, local unit of Minnesota government, or active military service. When you say accrue, is that just a bookkeeping entry, or by accruing vacation leave, does that obligate the state in your amendment to pay?
Maybe I should turn it over to Mr. Boomer. I think he probably knows the answer.
I read it to say, I mean, if you came in and, you know, if you'd stayed in your previous job and you would have gotten 3 weeks of vacation in your previous job, and of course, by starting in civil service, maybe you start with only 1 week, but since you would have earned 3 weeks, I guess you carry over. Is that what it says, Mr. Boomer?
Mr. Chairman, the intent here is that, for instance, if a person would start out with, 3 hours accrual per pay period, you would count the prior service. So if they had 4 years of service and it was over 10 years old, they would accrue at the 4 years service level rate. So it would be an additional accrual. You'd be probably looking at 1 to 2 hours of a pay period, depending upon how much service that individual had at the time that they left service.
Mr. Chair, the cost here is basically the fact that people are getting more vacation time. I mean, that's whatever cost it seems to be, which is a cost, of course, if someone's gone. So, Mr. Senator?
Well, I'm just trying to total it up in my head. This is only for a state employee that's currently employed. It doesn't reverse going the other way. Only in the event that a state employee appointed to a civil service position shall accrue. But you can add up. Now, I always think that a state government employee, and we've kind of blurred the line with state and county, at least with our pension funds, that they're kind of interchangeable with the funding for pensions. But I have a harder link between the federal government to accumulate that time and then add it. So it's just a little bit of a disconnect for me. And then the federal government is accruing, let's say a person worked for the federal government for 12 years. He starts an entry-level position somewhere in state government, and who knows what the accrual rate was in the federal government. It may not even be the same as what we do in state government. So I don't know how you link it. I'm not quite sure.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, not an expert on this, but in, again, going back to the other testifiers' comments, there would be a couple issues. You wouldn't be getting necessarily the hours at the accrual of the whatever the individual was accruing at the federal level. It was counted as the years of experience, and that's what you'd get at the state level. Currently, just depending on the plan, I think the different labor agreements have bargained it differently of what might be the background. When I started at employee at the department, they had the issue of they were able to exercise discretion at looking what my previous employer, what was pertinent to my current position, and then letting me accrue levels of service. So it is, there are differences out there, I know, for each employee, depending on what plan they're covered on.
So we have different policies that may be in different levels of government. You may have different collective bargaining agreements that have affected the accrual level in a host of different places. And then this proposal suggests that we accrue it all together for the total length of service. Other, at least in the private sector, if you don't use your vacation in some jobs, you lose your vacation after each year. Others, the longer you stay in service to a corporation, the more you accumulate vacation time, and others you don't. So other corporations, you can accumulate vacation leave, and if you don't take it at the end of your service to the company, you can get a cash equivalent for it. So how would that all fit with this linking of all of that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, what this would simply do is just take a look at the length of service that the individual had in the appropriate level of government and apply that to our schedule. So it would be applied, you know, it would not be the federal government accrual rate. It would take their years of experience, for instance, with the federal government and apply the state standard to that for whatever.
I wish I had a fiscal note on this. I don't even know how we would figure out.
Yeah, it does that.
We put it on the bill, Mr. Chairman. Yes. Then we can request a fiscal note. And quite frankly, if it had a huge fiscal note, I would move to take it off.
I guess if you're ready to go forward with that, that's fine. But well, I just wanted to explain to Senator Limmer that they do it right now, but they only go back 10 years. And so it discriminates against people like Vietnam vets and Gulf War vets. And so this is just
Civil War vets.
They do it.
Okay.
There's one left, I think.
No, Civil War, so they're all gone.
I was kidding.
In fact, I don't even think there's any World War I vets left in the world. So, okay, so again, Senator Rust moves the A6th Amendment, but if it's adopted, then we'd be laying the bill over to see what the fiscal note says. So Senator Rust moves the A6th Amendment. Discussion on that. Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
Okay, the motion prevails. Is there anybody else who wants to be heard then on Senate file 702 as amended? Seeing none, then Senator Tomasoni, I'm going to lay the bill over. We'll see what the fiscal note says, and we'll see you down the road.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay. We have two more bills. Senate file 157, Senator Rest, which bill did you want to do first? The presidential primary establishment?
Yes.
Okay, Senate file 157, presidential primary establishment. There's a fiscal note on that. Senator Rest?
Mr. Chairman and members, this bill is a bill that would allow for Minnesota to become part of the presidential primary cycle and for 2012 and would starting then and would, if it's passed, it would have to be actually passed this year, which is why I'm moving forward on it, and I actually hope that I can amend it on to another bill at some point, some appropriate bill. But it would allow us to become part of a Midwest regional primary, presidential primary, and Minnesota would be a real player in the presidential politics. It does have a requirement, but it does not for the results to be taken seriously by the parties in terms of the apportioning of their delegates to their national conventions. If a candidate drops out, there are provisions to by which they are those delegate spots are filled. And the one thing that's very different from the 1992 provisions is that you do not have to declare your party when you take a ballot. Everybody gets the same ballot. You just have to vote in your own party. So if you recall, in 1992, you went in and asked for a Democratic ballot, or you went in and asked for a Republican ballot, and that was public information and stayed on the Secretary of State's data for voting. The other provision that is different is, although it allows for petitioning to be to get your name on the ballot, there is also a filing fee of $5,000. So you can either get votes in every congressional district or petition signers in every congressional district, or for a nomination, 1,000 voters in each congressional district, or pay the filing fee of
of $5,000. The costs obviously wouldn't start until fiscal year 2012, and the costs to the state are limited to the dollars that are there. Otherwise, they would be picked up by obviously the local governments. I think most of us, or those of us that are on the state and local government committee, recall the hearings that we had following the 2008 precinct caucuses, and how there was a lot of enthusiasm, but there was also a lot of chaos in the way in which people indicated their interest in a particular presidential candidate. This also calls for precinct caucuses to be held on the same night following the presidential primary. It does not interfere with any other kinds of endorsements or putting forward of people's names for the legislature or anything like that. But it does bring Minnesota into the possibility of being part of a regional primary, presidential primary, which would include the Midwest regional primary, would include those states lying west of Pennsylvania, north of Arkansas, east of Wyoming. Would not interfere with Iowa or New Hampshire or any of the early states, et cetera. But so that's kind of a very brief summary of the bill, and the costs are described in the fiscal note, and they are limited. It's not inconsiderable because, of course, it is it's a statewide election, and the issue is whether this particular cost in the service of democracy is one that Minnesota wants to be part of. If not, it seems to me that what's going to happen is that in terms of picking our presidential candidates from either party, that Minnesota could become irrelevant. So that's the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Well, and of course, this would not qualify for HAVA funds because this is not an election per se. I do recall in the testimony of the policy committee from the local election clerks who did say that there was going to be a local cost to them, and they saw that a presidential preference primary was more of a political party activity instead of an election. I mean, the election.
So too is the primary election, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, well, they saw primary election as an integral part of the November election. Mm-hmm. But the testimony that I recall was from the local officials. They said that they didn't see this on par with the primary, but that was their testimony. But regardless, the fiscal note is here. It does not affect the current biennium or the biennium that we're passing the budget for that we passed yesterday. It does have some tails which were not booked into the bill we passed yesterday. So if anything, I mean, we could, however we deal with it, if it went to the Finance Committee, we just have to be, I'd have to tell Senator Cohen, here's a bill, it's got some tails, and we didn't adjust for it in our bill.
I understand, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Okay, well,
Mr. Chairman, I would move adoption of the bill and referring it to full finance and see whether I can convince Senator Cohen that this is a worthwhile thing to take up in the full committee.
Senator Rest, would you do me a favor and make your motion without recommendation?
Yes,
because
I'd be
again,
happy to
since
that.
We haven't paid for
yes.
it, I don't know what to tell
happy
the finance
to do
committee.
That. So, okay. I would move the bill without recommendation for the finance.
Senator Rest moves that Senate File 157, first engrossment, be recommended with or sent to the Finance Committee without recommendation. Is there discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
Okay. The motion prevails, and the last bill on today's agenda
is
Senate File 791, the runoff election requirements. Senator
Mr.
West.
Chairman and members, if Senate File 791 was current law, we would have two sitting members of the United States Senate from Minnesota. This is a bill that sets an even closer margin to initiate a runoff election between candidates for statewide office. That is, it would be limited to the U.S. Senate, constitutional officers, and the judges that run statewide. The margin would have to be 1/8 of 1%. We just heard the recount bill that Senator Sieben had for the general recounts and how much savings that would be if you limited them to 1/4 of 1%. This, I believe, would happen very, very rarely, as maybe once every 20 years, which is what we're seeing now in the current contest. But it would have allowed, after the canvassing board made their determination, if that was less than 1/8 of 1%, a runoff election to occur, and would have taken place within 30 days afterwards, with automatic absentee balloting going on. Anybody who had applied for an absentee ballot in a regular election would get one in this runoff election. And if the runoff election also was conducted and ended up with a very small difference between the candidates, it would be an automatic election contest and I just go to the court phase, which I think is even rarer than even having the runoff election. So it's fairly straightforward. We do not do it in any other elections. We don't have runoff elections in Minnesota, but it seems to me that for our statewide offices that this is preferable to the condition that we find ourselves in now, and even in the Rolvog Anderson election of 1962. And then the fiscal note.
Right.
The fiscal note is $8,000 from the HAVA money.
It's HAVA money. Now, I do note, if you look at page 6 of 6 of the fiscal note, this is the part that was signed off by the campaign disclosure board. The last paragraph talks about the extremely remote possibility of a constitutional runoff election. It said the amount of public subsidy depends upon the office. And so apparently they think that there could be a remote possibility in there, but it doesn't show any numbers on that. So.
Right.
Okay. Is there anybody who wants to be heard on Senate File 791, first engrossment?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
Well, it's similar to what you were just saying at the bottom of page 3. Again, if in the remote possibility, there would be a cost to local governments of $3.8 million.
Yeah, oh, yes.
Okay.
It is a regular election, and we just have to, again, ask ourselves the question of what is the preference in terms of our representative government, and I would submit that this is a better preference and a better use of remote possibility use of state and local tax dollars for the privilege of having, in this instance, a United States senator that would have taken office in January.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
And Senator Rest, the intention is that it's for the top two vote getters. that correct?
It would even be more remote that the top, that if there were three people running, that they would be separated by less than 1/8 of 1%.
Yeah.
So it's really very, very narrow, and I think would be, and if there was less than 1/8, there would be no runoff, and there would be a winner declared. No, there'd be a winner declared.
But the top two vote getters are in the runoff.
Yes.
Unless the third candidate is within 1/8.
That would be also within that 1/8. It would be
very.
I mean, it would be 33.33.33.33.33.33. Okay. Or maybe it would be 30 point something, and then there'd be lesser candidates that filled in the bottom, but that they would all be within.
And they would not run again.
And the other ones would not be on the ballot.
I've had a slightly different way of approaching the issue. Again, this is a budget area, but it just sort of seems to me that just because the election is close doesn't necessarily mean you should have another election. I mean, we have a problem with the U.S. Senate race because we've got a lot of laws dealing with absentee ballots, a lot of other things that had the changes been in place, we could have streamlined this process. But I think there is a problem, though, when you get somebody elected, particularly statewide, with less than a majority vote,
yes,
which we had in this U.S.
Right.
Senate race. I mean, with candidate Barkley in there,
right,
neither Mr. Coleman nor Mr. Franken got 50%.
Right.
So have a runoff if neither gets a majority would it be appropriate. Or for that matter, the last three governors, Governor Ventura and Governor Plenty twice, not one of them got more than 50%. Now, I have a hunch that in a runoff, maybe the same result would have happened. Who knows? I mean, Governor Ventura, I think he had 30% of the vote, 21. And had there been a runoff, it'd be between him and Norm Coleman. I think Ventura would have won that runoff. But who knows? But he won was 30. He got to be governor with 37% of the vote. Which meant that over 2/3 of the people voted for somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point you say, is that how they're supposed to run? But the current rule is you get more votes than the other guys, you win. And that's how it works. So.
Chairman, I do think that's a real problem that you mentioned, but it's not the problem that's being addressed by this bill.
But that's why I come at from a slightly different angle, and that's why I've had some issues about the underlying bill. But as I said, the fiscal note is the issue, and even if it would be my proposal, I think the fiscal note would be the same. So,
yeah. Well, so, Mr. Chairman,
Sarah Babbis.
I think that when you win in such a close election, I think whoever in the Franken-Coleman race ends up with the 300 votes or whatever it is. I think there's you're always subject to being called in question the legitimacy of the election. So when it is under 50%, so I do think having a runoff, it's been clear, I think, to the voters of the state. You know, I suppose unless it's 50.1% and 49.9% or something, which could happen.
I don't think President George W. Bush looked back and said, "Geez, I lost the
right
national vote, and I only won by a little bit." So, no, he just said,
"I won.
I got the electoral votes. I won." So,
Mr. Roebling, the truth is that people questioned the legitimacy of that all through the rest of his term.
I don't think he ever did. So,
no, he may not have, but a lot of people in
the public
did.
Right.
But at the end, you have to have a winner. You have to have somebody who says, "Okay, we're not going to have co-presidents or co-senators. Somebody's got to be it." But you know, how to get there is what's vexing us all session long. Yes. Yeah. Sarah,
one question I had, Senator Rest, is what is what was it, 1/8?
Mm-hmm.
What does that equal in an average election number-wise?
Well, right now, 1/2 of 1% was 15,000 votes. So 1/4 is 7,500.
Uh-huh.
So I'm just doing the math here. So 1/8 is like
3,500. Okay.
3750.
Okay. Now we just had
and the reason that I went with that lower one is we had testimony from the election officials, from the Secretary of State, that the machine counts were fairly accurate and that we know that with all the recount that there's a difference, but That difference was less than 300 votes, so that was a legitimate, really, really legitimate. But if it had been, you know, if it had been 3,700 votes, I doubt that we would be seeing an election contest right now.
But if we pass
if it was
this,
that, if it had been that many.
But if we pass this, we might have an election, a new election. Less.
No, it still says the canvassing board has to certify the election or not.
Oh. I was just thinking that perhaps a smaller number might be more appropriate because
this is pretty small.
Under 1,000.
Yeah, I was thinking 1,000 maybe, 1,000 votes or 900 or so. Mm-hmm. And the only reason is that we do have the means electronically to count down to a pretty good margin of error.
I know.
And 3,700 might be just a little large compared to the electronic capability that we have. And so
and
it recognizes a margin of error in a smaller degree.
And, Mr. Chairman, in one way, I don't disagree with you, Senator Limmer, but I, you know, right now it's 0.5%. On the Secretary of State's supporting for just recounts, now moving it down to 0.25%, and this is even smaller for these particular offices to do the runoff, and. Right now, that's about as low as I'm comfortable going. That's all.
And
no particular reason, a particular reason in that it's a long way to go from 15,000 to 3,750, even with our increased confidence in the electronic voting. So it seemed to me that the 1/8 was reasonable.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Rest. Your starting number, are you starting with, what number are you starting with? Is that a typical race?
3 million, statewide, 3 million votes cast.
Okay, so is that a typical number for a statewide election?
That is the number that were cast in the election in 2008. So if we only had 2 million votes cast, it would be much less, but Minnesota has had consistently high voter turnout, so I don't think we're going to see much or fewer than that on any regular occasion, particularly if a race is going to be this close. There's going to be a high voter turnout. It would be a close race from the beginning in terms of the candidates involved.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, I think I agree with Senator Limmer that I think you should consider a smaller number because when you think about
still,
you want the candidate's election to be legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think, though, if there's more than 1,000 votes difference, to me, you know, that establishes the winner. But if it's getting less than 1,000 votes, 500 votes, you know, as we've seen in this election between Coleman and Franken where it's 300 votes, 200 votes, 500 votes, whatever. You know, that seems very, very close in a statewide election. But once you're getting up to 3,000 or 4,000, like you have, that doesn't seem very close to me.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe
yeah.
out of 3 million, it may, you know, seem close. But when actual numbers, I can't imagine that, you know, there'd be mistakes of that, even of that magnitude.
Yeah, so Senator Jungbauer.
I'm not going to offer an amendment,
yeah.
but I think you should think about it.
I think we'll see an amendment at some point between now and final passage. Senator Jungbauer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I think if you look at page 2, line 2.25, under the automatic recounts, I think we should just we could solve this by talking about, because in the automatic recount, the losing candidate can waive the recount based on that number. If we also put they could waive the runoff election based on that number,
yeah.
we've really solved the problem.
Hmm.
Right. So a losing candidate who could say, gee, I don't want to put the state
right.
through.
Like we had in the
election.
Other bill.
Mm.
So I guess I'd make that an amendment.
Oh, sure.
If we take and make a comma after may waive a recount, comma, or runoff election required pursuant to this.
Okay. Well, give counsel just a second or two to see.
Yeah, right.
If any other changes need to be made here, I
Because that's really what we're saying is, yeah. is we don't yeah. want to automatically go to right. this. We want to give the candidate the right to waive that potential.
Sure. Just let's just hold up a second here.
Mr. Chairman, I think what you'd want to do is just take that sentence that you see in existing language on page 2, line 25, just to make sure that it applies to the runoff election. You'd want to put it on page 3 at the end of that new subdivision. On page 3, line 4, might be best to separate it in a new, create two paragraphs here within the subdivision 4. And we'll make this the paragraph B. A losing candidate may waive the runoff election required by this subdivision by filing a written notice of waiver. I don't know if you'd want to do it with I think you'd say the Secretary of State in this instance yeah. rather than mm-hmm. the canvassing board.
Perhaps we could adopt the amendment with give council leeway to make appropriate adjustments.
That'd be great.
Is that okay? So, Senator Jungbauer, are you making that motion?
Yes, I'd be making that motion, Mr. Chair.
Senator Jungbauer moves language as read by council, which could be modified by council. Is there discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, the amendment's adopted. Further discussion? Is there anybody else who's here who wants to be heard on Senate File 791, First Engrossment, as amended? Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 791, the First Engrossment, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the full committee. And once again, I will try and find a home for this bill, too.
Okay. On that motion, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
As opposed, no. No.
No.
The motion prevails.
Thank you.
Members, again, we'll probably have one more meeting within the next week or so. We've got Senator Lurie's gambling bill to look at, Senator Tomasoni's bill that we laid over. Senator Gerlach had that bill we laid over. Senator Rest has a bill or so that we're trying to figure out the status. Apparently, the House has strange mating habits when they put bills together, so we got to figure out what's where. But I want to thank our staff, again, Mr. Bodner, Mr. Lundeen, for your work on the omnibus bill, our partisan and nonpartisan staff, and I want to thank the members here for your votes yesterday on the omnibus bill. You know, Sarah Pogermiller wanted to take up last Friday, you know, and I said, well, it just came out of the Finance Committee.
Yeah.
I said, I don't think the committee report's ready. He said, well, let's do it tomorrow, Saturday. I said, we don't want to come out. I said, the bill's going to take 20 minutes, you know. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. So anyway, everybody had the whole weekend to think of amendments. So, but I appreciated it. It was fun, folks, and it surprised everybody, including me. So anyway, thank you, and we'll yes. See you soon. Have a good one. Thank you. Bye.
Meeting's adjourned.
Thank you. Bye.